everyone. Welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Geoffrey Wonsall. I'm not here with my daughter Molly today. She's busy as ever, looking after her many clients, and I'm, as usual, sitting in front of my laptop, trying to talk to you all again. I must say it is wonderful that we have so many devoted listeners. It's absolutely tremendous. And thank you so much for your support and your suggestions and ideas and just general goodwill. It makes an enormous difference to me, and I know it does to Molly. So thank you again. This has been, I think this is our fifth anniversary. We started in October, believe it or not, 2017. Goodness me. Yeah, what a shock. I never imagined I'd still be doing this. But there you go. I still seem to be one way and another. Kind of relentlessly. But it's very flattering, and it's a wonderful treat to talk to the wonderful Blood Ties listeners, without whom my life would be much less interesting. So today, this first podcast I'm doing on my own of this section, I'm going to talk about a few things that really interest me about true crime at the moment. First one, and I'm afraid this is for the UK listeners, there has been a drama playing on television this week on Channel 5 called Maxine, built around Maxine Carr, which those of you who remember the case was, of course, the girl in the Soham murder case. Ian Huntley killed Jessica Chapman and Holly Wells on that August day in 2002 in Soham, a small village in Cambridgeshire, disposed of the bodies. And Carr gave him an alibi. In fact, the alibi fell apart in the end. But the drama, which is three parts, 1 hour each, or at least 46 minutes of actual drama time, because of the advertisements, it worried me. I'm not alone in being worried about it. A lot of the commentariat, particularly the critics and some of the viewers, were very, very critical of it, because they said or felt that it humanised Huntley, whom they truly believe is a monster. I think it was probably a poor decision to make the drama in the first place. I don't see how you can do it without making them seem sympathetic. And they weren't, to be honest. So the first thing I wanted to talk about really was how little the drama, as I say, called Maxine, paid any attention to the parents of the two girls. As you know, one of my abiding passions at the moment is to remember the victims' families. And this drama showed no reflection of the terrible damage that these two murders, the murders of these two 10-year-old girls wearing their Manchester United strip, did to the families. It is unbelievable. I mean, Kevin Wells, the father of Holly, in the end wrote a book about it. And I dug out my old notes on Kevin Wells. And he said at the time, "The fact is, some bastard has thrown my daughter in a ditch as though she were a piece of rubbish." But he will not take anything else away from my family. It's time to stand strong, and we will not go under. Time doesn't heal. Someone got that wrong, he went on. It anaesthetizes. Grief does not diminish, but you can manage the intensity and learn to live with it. Murder has the capacity to destroy more lives than the one taken. I recognised that from the start, so I tried to take control, to make plans and to exert positive thought. I clung to my family, my community, my work, sometimes to God, and sometimes to a late-night tumbler of whiskey. I chose to believe in the future, a future that I could craft from the life we once had. Really, all I wanted was for us to be the ones who'd make it out the other side. Losing Holly was excruciating, but I have yet to see anything to persuade me that the mother's loss, Nicola's, is not the greater. They say, Kevin Wells went on, 95% of the parents of murdered children split up. We were determined to be among the 5% who survived, but for a year, perhaps 18 months, I couldn't reach my knife. She was lost in a kind of wilderness, whereas I was more hard-line about my emotions. I wrote a diary. We broke down together, he went on. It is an amazingly honest, honourable account of the horrible price that the Wells and Chapman families paid for Ian Huntley's disgusting crime. And it truly was a disgusting crime. I mean, all his pretense of it was an accident and she had a nosebleed and, oh, one fell in the bath and accidentally drowned in 18 inches of water. Absolute nonsense. Merely covered up his own clearly sexual intentions. He's always denied that. And another thing that annoyed me about the programme, about the drama, was that Huntley was portrayed as somehow slightly weak and feeble. It didn't point out, as I believe it should have done, except in one instance, that he actually abused Carr. He was a wife beater. They were only engaged, but his first wife, Huntley's original wife, Claire, who left him for his brother, Ian, attested to it. There can be no doubt that not only was Huntley a paedophile, but he was also a wife beater. He was a man who hated women. And to see him portrayed as a sort of rather snivelling, weak wreck seems to me to take my breath away. Maxine Carr was a timid, uncertain young woman, not at all the young woman that was portrayed in the drama. And so you have a false view of this really strange couple, added to the horror of the murders themselves. I mean, these two poor girls were taken to a ditch on the edge of RAF Lakenheath, stripped of their clothes, chucked down in the ditch. Petrol was poured over them by Huntley, and they were set alight in an effort to conceal any forensic evidence there might have been. That is not the actions of a man of, how can one put it, who's frightened. Those were the actions of a man who was absolutely determined to try and shake off any suspicion. This is the man, for example, who said, oh, yes, I suppose I might have been the last person to see the girls alive. An act of narcissism. I've always dreaded to think, and I do feel dreadfully for the Wells and Chapman's families, what Huntley actually did, apart from, which we now know, shoving their dead bodies in the boot of his Ford Fiesta, where they remained throughout the Sunday night into the Monday morning when he took them to Lakenheath. No. I'm sorry. And the whole programme, I watched it carefully. I went back to watch the end again just to make sure what I thought. It ends with the arrest of Huntley and Carr. It doesn't take in, which is in fact fascinating, their appearance at the Old Bailey when she turned against him and in fact withdrew the alibi. There is something about true crime drama that can sometimes be distinctly unsettling. And I think, though this one will have gained a great deal of interest, because, of course, it's a very notorious case, but there was something about it that really did make me feel uncomfortable. And I'd love to hear what the Blood Ties listeners thought. I mean, do send us, you know, messages. And because I don't think I'm alone. I think it, I felt it was exploitative. Which is, I'm sure the programme makers didn't set out, but I think the original decision to commission and get written a three-part drama, which doesn't tell the whole story, which conceals the awfulness of the crimes, and doesn't take into account the awful price that the families paid for the girls' disappearance and murder, it somehow didn't feel to me so something that one really wanted to do. I mean, I've acted. I acted as a consultant on the programme on which Netflix made about Dennis Nielsen. Now, no one would say for a moment that Nielsen was anything but a monster. And in fact, the programme displayed that. But this programme didn't even really demonstrate why on earth Carr decided to give him an alibi, when it was perfectly obvious her alibi was that she was with him in the house when the girls came to see, but she didn't see them because she was in the bath. The reality was that she'd been visiting her mother in Grimsby on that night, and that she didn't get back until the next day. Eventually, of course, that came to light, because she turns up on television talking about the girls, displaying the note that Holly had written to her, because she's a teaching assistant at the girls' school. And someone in Grimsby, of course, says, hang on a minute. She was here that night. I remember her. Well, it's... I don't know that they'd got Maxine Carr right. No commentary on the actress, who did the very best she could with the role. But that isn't quite the Maxine Carr, this timid, uncertain, frightened girl, who was about 3 years younger than Huntley. Now, I think Huntley was much more manipulative than he was being displayed. I think there was much more to it than that. But let's not go back over what was, in fact, a horrifying case. Because we've done it. I mean, Molly and I have done the Soham murders. But I just thought that this drama brought a lot of it back to me. And it raised my... It made me think about what anyone who does what I do, what we should be thinking. Are we, and I know I've raised this with Molly before, and I hope you'll forgive me for raising it again. Are we somehow glamorising the perpetrators and failing to truly reflect the horror of what they did? Because it truly was horrific. And also, the drama didn't reflect, and I suppose this is not what it set out to do, but it didn't reflect Huntley's behaviour at the Old Bailey. It didn't reflect the drama of the case. But it did raise a moral issue. And that moral issue is, surely now, in the age we live, in which so many dreadful things are capable of happening, we must be much more conscious, much, of the pain and suffering that these dreadful crimes cause. And that is, in itself, something that continues to haunt me. But let me draw a comparison with a Netflix series, which I'm sure our listeners around the world will know about and be able to see, about Jeffrey Dahmer. Now, Dahmer really deserves to be called horrific, a monster, evil. He took some pleasure in devouring parts of his victims. But the Netflix drama did was it took it much more from the point of view of the victims. And in that sense, I heartily applaud it. Now, you could say, you can argue that I'm arguing against myself. In other words, isn't it in danger? 10 episodes is a lot of episodes. Isn't it in danger of making Dharma glamorous? Well, yes, up to a point. But I also think that it was shrewd enough and careful enough to point out that the victims were not necessarily, how can we put it, asking for it. They were trapped in a web of the creation of Jeffrey Dahmer. And in that respect, I think that it was much more appropriate. No, it wasn't perfect, and there's been some criticism around the world of the programmes, of the 10 episodes, for the precise point that it made him look a bit glamorous. And no, he wasn't. But he came to an extremely sticky end, literally, in prison, when he was beaten to death by a fellow inmate after he'd been sentenced to life without parole. I think that the programme makers there, the final episode, God of Forgiveness, God of Vengeance, is very telling. Dharma, to some extent, found religion once he'd accepted that he was going to get jail for the rest of his life. And was asking for forgiveness. But his attacker viewed, again, a Christian, though black as against Dharma being white, viewed his God as one that demanded vengeance. Just going back for a moment to Huntley, you will remember that Huntley has been attacked 3 times in prison. Had boiling water poured over him, had his face slashed with a makeshift blade. He's taken pills, tried to kill himself twice. Dharma seemed, on the other hand, to have accepted that what he had done was utterly wrong, monstrous, evil, whatever words you want to use. And that is that at least was something. It offered you something that gave you a sense of justice. Now, I've spent a lot of time this week thinking about justice because I've also been reading 2 books about the Old Bailey, the Central Criminal Court in London. And it caused me to spend a lot of time considering what I mean. But those of you who've read any of my books, certainly Lifers or Pure Evil, as it's known in paperback, know that I'm not certain what I feel exactly about how we view prison and the imprisonment of heinous offenders. Should it be life for life? Should it be life without parole? Should there always be the prospect of parole? It's a conundrum, a moral question that I've grappled with and am still grappling with. But nevertheless, it's my view, at least at the moment, is that we have to consider very carefully how we deal with offenders, particularly multiple killers. So that's what you might describe as what's been preoccupying me. Another Netflix series, which I've only seen the first 2 episodes of, which I do heartily recommend, is called Inside the Criminal Mind. And among the things that it suggests, and I think it's going to examine a lot of cases, so I think it's got plenty of time to develop, is that there is a triangle of indicators of a potential serial killer. And those, all displayed in childhood, and those of you who listen to this podcast regularly will know that Molly and I often refer to it, that include arson as a child, hurting furry animals, pets, and bedwetting. I don't think those are the only things, but they are clear indications later in life. But not every serial killer demonstrates those characteristics. And in my next solo podcast, I'm going to talk about a man, a Briton, called Anthony Hardy, who demonstrated none of those characteristics and yet was a serial killer. But let's leave that to the next podcast. As for this one, well, what else? I've really enjoyed a wonderful series on called The Old Guy with Jeff Bridges and John Lithgow, about a retired assassin who they decide they better eliminate, and he fights to avoid his elimination. It comes out in the United Kingdom on every Friday, and I think it's Disney Plus. But hugely, hugely entertaining, very interesting, and for someone who reviews thrillers as I do for the Daily Mail in England, very much my cup of tea. Well, what else has been happening? One of the things that's caught the public attention in this country, in Britain, is the trial of a nurse called Lucy Letby, who's alleged to have murdered 7 babies and tried to kill another 10. The trial is continuing. It's fascinating, as these trials always are, because you keep asking yourself the question, why? But if you remember the case of Beverly Allitt, which, again, Molly and I have done, it's always a fascinating one. Do you want to play God? Is it Munchausen syndrome by proxy? You want to be loved? You want to draw attention to yourself? What is it? It's a fascinating... Lucy Letby is innocent until proven guilty, and she's still being tried. So it's a fascinating case, but it's an ongoing one. Also, a couple of things to reflect on. Two of the killers that we've dealt with on Blood Ties have died recently. Peter Tobin, who you may remember killed Angelica Cluck and buried her under the pulpit in a church in Glasgow, and Russell Bishop, the Babes in the Wood killer, who killed the 2 little girls in Brighton and left them in a little camp in the woods and then participated in the search for them. I don't think anyone will shed a single tear over either Tobin or Bishop, but it's interesting that they died almost exactly the same time. In the end, they were never going to get out of jail, that's for sure, but goodness, we live in such strange times. That's what I constantly find myself reflecting on. What is it about society? What does it want? Does it want to rehabilitate offenders who commit such heinous crimes, or does it just want to lock them up and throw away the key? Should we be looking at rehabilitation, or should we just ignore it? As an MP once put it very bluntly to me many years ago, there's not a single vote in prisons, and that's never been more true. The first service to be cut is almost always the prison service, which is not entirely right. But just before I finish, let me tell you about the 2 books I've been reading. I'm very interested in the Old Bailey, the Central Criminal Court. And I've recently been sent 2 really excellent books on the Old Bailey. one by a KC, Thomas Grant, Tom Grant, called Court Number One, The Old Bailey. It's published by John Murray, and it's an excellent history of the Number One Court, which is the principal court at the Old Bailey, and goes back over a series of trials that have taken place there. And funnily enough, it ends up with Huntley and Carr. And it was very good for me to go back and read the Huntley-Carr trial, because it reminded me just how dramatic trials like that can be. I've been to a few, and they are the most extraordinary events. I've sat in the Old Bailey. I think the first time I ever went was in 1971. But when you could still use the old front entrance and before the new bit was added on in 1976. But my goodness me, I was there when the IRA bomb went off. It's an extraordinary place. And Tom Grant's book, which includes a whole series of very interesting, very, very interesting cases going back over the past, as I say, ends with Huntley and Carr, but begins with all manner of other marvellous cases, including, of course, Timothy Evans, who died, was hanged, and Ruth Ellis, both of which Molly and I have done. So I heartily recommend it. It's called Court Number One, The Old Bailey, and it's written by Thomas Grant, KC. The other book is every bit as fascinating. This book is written by a lady judge, Her Honour Wendy Joseph, who became the first lady to become a permanent judge at the Old Bailey. She sat as a full-time judge there from 2007 to 2022. When she moved to the Old Bailey in 2012, she was the only woman amongst 16 judges and only the third woman ever to hold a permanent position there. She describes six cases. She doesn't go into details, and she describes them as the judge sees them. And it raises some fascinating moral questions. It's a very, very beautifully done, very well written. Asking us what we think about gang culture, what we think about honour killings. I found it utterly riveting. And so it's called, let me give you the details, it's called Unlawful Killings. It's by Her Honour Wendy Joseph QC, now of course KC, although she's retired, and it's published by Doubleday. If you're interested in that kind of thing, if you're interested in legal adventures, which I am fascinated by, I mean, for example, if you like The Lincoln Lawyer on television or in the book written by Michael Connolly, if you like Scott Turow's Presumed Innocent, if you like a lot of John Grisham, which takes place in courtrooms, it's a really wonderful illumination of an exciting... It's drama, high drama. Trials, particularly for murder, are the highest possible drama. There is nothing else like it. It is really a matter of no longer life or death, because of course we've abandoned the death penalty in England. But it is the highest possible drama. So those are, if you like, a few reflections on true crime that have been going through my mind over the past week or so. And the more I deal with it, the more I think about it, in a sense, the less certain I am about what's the way out, How do we get it right? By and large, I think we do get it broadly right, but there are issues. And my, as you know, all know, my foremost issue is with the pain and suffering brought to the families and friends of those who perish at the hands of a serial killer. But let me end on a more cheerful note. I'm looking forward to seeing a next episode of The Old Guy with Jeff Bridges, who caught COVID during the filming and they had to postpone it for almost 2 years. But anyway, we finished it. Very good. It's excellent. I've enjoyed that. I've enjoyed a lot of things. I seem to be relentlessly on a channel in this country called Sky Crime because they're running my new series of Britain's Most Evil Killers and World's Most Evil Killers right up until Christmas. And all the old ones are being replayed. So it's almost impossible to escape me, as some people stop me and say, every time I go to bed and switch on the late night television, you're on there. I say, I'm terribly sorry, don't switch it on. But it's very kind of them to consider me. So, as ever, I must thank everybody who helps us, our marvellous producer, Sam Brain, my son, Dan, who composed the music, George, who drew the caricature, Audio Boom for hosting us, and my daughter Molly, whose idea this was, and who for whom I have nothing but the highest admiration. It was a brilliant idea, of which I am immensely proud, as I've said before. So, as I often say at the end of these podcasts, do, if you can, be careful out there.